This, blokes, is an impression of two announcers from foreign stations broadcasting in English for your amusement. This was inspired by Jonah Barrington of the Daily Express. We're two famous people you've heard on the air. We talk propaganda to you over there.
A nice Oxford accent, a touch of the cam. We just have a mic and it's money for Jem. Up the Fuhrer.
Uncle Boohoo of Moscow.
Lord Haw-Haw of Caesar.
We broadcast in English.
We'll tell you the reason.
My name is Cuthbert.
And my name is Basil.
The Fuhrer has told us our monocles dazzle.
And after the war, we'll be writing in razzle.
Uncle Boohoo of Moscow.
Lord Haw-Haw of Caesar. Hurrah for ribbon tripe. Trop.
Uncle Boohoo of Moscow.
Lord Haw-Haw of Caesar.
We may be two Britishers.
Three cheers for treason.
I drink Russian tea, no milk and no sugar. Vodka, of course, and a lager or lager.
Sausage for me, I'm a proper hamburger.
Uncle Boohoo of Moscow.
Lord Haw-Haw of Caesar.
Out of a population of 80 millions, we now have a standing army of 150 millions.
Where is the Ark Royal?
Uncle Boohoo of Moscow.
Lord Haw-Haw of Caesar.
We wear woolly camisoles.
In the cold season.
The Fuhrer is fond of the flower the sun kisses. And in his Burke's garden, a stroll never misses.
He says I remind him so much of Narcissus.
Uncle Boohoo of Moscow.
Lord Haw-Haw of Caesar. This autumn we have a wonderful crop of radishes. I will repeat that.
Uncle Boohoo of Moscow.
Lord Haw-Haw of Caesar.
No butter, perhaps.
But bread to put cheese on.
Mr. Knickerbocker has said Dr. Goebbels is yawning, with millions of pounds put away, sort of pawning.
Mr. Knickerbocker's knickerbockers will be sunk without warning.
Uncle Boohoo of Moscow.
Lord Haw-Haw of Caesar. The higher the Fuhrer.
A song, Cads, we've dedicated to the Empire. St. George for England, St. Pancras for Scotland. Bad show, chaps, bad show.
What's the blackout coming to? That's the latest cry. We'll even have to whitewash the jolly old school tar.
We're sliding down the banisters, we're going up the spout, we're walking into lampposts. What's it all about? Sic transit Gloria Petroleum.
There's still a lot of flirting going on in Regent's Park.
Bad show, chaps, bad show.
Toscanini whistles, jeepers creepers in the dark.
Bad show, chaps, bad show.
Statesmen do not use the diplomacy they might. Attlee goes to Downing Street, it really isn't right.
He stands and sings Umbrella Man to Neville every night.
Bad show, chaps, bad show.
Hardly playing the game, you know.
Mademoiselle from Armentiers has rather gone to sea.
Oh, bad show, chaps, bad show.
She's going in for comfort now, she's given up the speed.
Bad show, chaps, bad show.
Sir John Anderson is a conscientious man.
Rather.
Delivering his shelters, he comes round with his van.
It's not the thing to ask him if there's tuppence on the can.
Bad show, chaps, bad show.
Pro bono, penny on the bureau.
It's time the ancient Britisher should answer to the call and all go marching forward with our backs against the wall.
The farmer has a subsidy to help him grow the stuff, though Stafford Cripps says raspberries are plentiful enough, wearing his popular front, of course.
Simon raised the income tax and everybody ducked.
Bad show, chaps. Bad show.
And Mr. Harbelisha has had his eyebrows plucked.
Bad show, chaps. Bad show.
The fast of Mr. Gandhi worried Burma and Bengal. He sat there in his loincloth, the viceroy made a call.
And he found out it was only night starvation after all.
Bad show, chaps. Bad show.
On his swark, he maldemir, which means do not wash your hands while a train is at a station.
The balloon barrage over London was said to be a flop. Some balloons broke right away while others went off pop.
So they're sending up Sir Kingsley Wood with Florrie Ford on top.
Oh, bad show, chaps. Bad show.
Definitely.
The Germans on the Western Front have shivers down the spine. They're calling up the women folk to help defend the Rhine.
So think of all those bloomers on the Siegfried line.
A bad show, chaps. Bad show.
Good hunting.
They calling. Germany calling. Here are the Reichs under ambush. Station Bremen. And station DXB on the 31-meter band.
Welcome to Radio Albion. Toilet of England by William Joyce, Chapter 7. The date is 13th of October, 2013. First you heard the Western Brothers. That was two songs of theirs called Lord Haw Haw of Zeeson and Bad Show Chaps. The Western Brothers were Kenneth Alfred Weston and George Weston, an English music hall and radio act who were popular from the 1930s to the late 1950s, performing self-written comic songs, wearing evening dress and monocles. During World War II, Lord Haw Haw was often mocked by the British media. This phenomenon grew widespread, and the Western Brothers were quick to create a song based on Lord Haw Haw. It contained the lines, Uncle Boohoo of Moscow and Lord Haw Haw of Zeeson. We may be two Britishers, but three cheers for treason. The song was so popular with the audiences that the Western Brothers had to move it to the end of the show to not interrupt the flow of the skits. Subsequently, British Columbia Records issued a recording of their song with the unusual distinction of having the Western Brothers logo, old school toy, on the label. Kenneth and George took their act on the road throughout the late 1940s, and although their popularity was in decline, they continued to appear as late as 1962. They shared the billing with Julie Andrews and Enzo Tapano in Harold Fielding's music For the Millions in August 1950 at the Winter Gardens in Bournemouth. Several of the Western Brothers' most famous songs can be found on several music hall CDs. Tony Barker of the Music Hall magazine has issued a single CD containing 21 of their songs, arranged chronologically from 1932 through 1941. That CD can be found at the Music Hall website. Now on to Chapter 7 of Twilight Over England by William Joyce. Chapter 7, The Empire. It is only a presumptuous person who would attempt to discuss the subject of the British Empire in a few pages. However, a close study of the people whom we discussed in the last chapter renders an attitude of presumption almost unavoidable. And, whilst the mood lasts, we might as well take advantage of it. It is not my purpose to indulge in recriminations or to recite a list of England's dark deeds in the past. The British Empire was, in the main, formed by acts of armed force, and from the many campaigns fought in order to achieve its creation, it is not possible to disassociate the cruelties which so often accompany wars of conquest. In this respect, however, England does not stand alone. The history of the formation of the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, and many other empires is a record of violence and often ruthlessness. It is only when England's politicians assume the white mantle of virtue and sanctimoniously claim an immaculate certificate of humanity for everything connected with British imperial history, or when they accuse other nations of gaining their ends by force, that one has to observe politely but firmly that England's record in Ireland, Africa, India, North America, Malta, China and Palestine stops her from criticising those who may choose to employ military force in pursuit of their objectives. The rights and wrongs of each case are beyond discussion here. Suffice it to say that even during the present century, British governments have used considerable force in South Africa, India, Palestine and Ireland. For whatever purpose it may have been employed, it has been used with sufficient frequency and vigour to warrant the judgment that England is prepared to realise her aims by military force without regard to the weakness or the wishes of those people against whom it is employed. Thus, for example, if it to be said that Russia invaded Poland only because the morals of the poor innocent commissars had been corrupted by their wicked Nazis, the wicked Nazis themselves had been corrupted by reading, in their youth, the exploits of Raleigh, Marlborough, Clive, Hastings, Wellesley, Napier, Cordington, Roberts, Rhodes, Jameson, Kitchener and Wolseley, to say nothing of Hawke, Kins, Mountjoy, Carew and Oliver Cromwell. A serious study of these biographies by apt pupils would leave one gasping at the modesty of the military measures that Germany has recently taken in Europe. Presumably, however, Sir John Hawkins founded the slave trade in the sacred cause of democracy. Mountjoy and Carew decimated the Irish population in the interests of small nationalities, and there can be little doubt that Kitchener's drastic treatment of the Boers in the closing stages of the South African War was merely intended to provide that mortification of the flesh which disposes the spirit the more readily to grasp the celestial mysteries of international finance. On the other hand, I have no wish to conceal from the reader the fact that I was brought up to admire and honour the British Empire. I saw in it an immense potentiality for good. If properly used so, obviously did the Führer. More than once he has paid tribute to some of England's imperial achievements, and often in his famous speech of October 6, 1939, he showed no hostility to the concept of a British Empire. On the contrary, he made a most generous offer of recognition. It is therefore outside the competence of my critics to say that in this chapter I am stating an ex parte case against the Empire's existence. On the contrary, I believe that every genuine movement of integration is a real advance in civilization. A large system of units organised into true corporations is just as beneficial to world peace as a large number of little units squabbling amongst themselves must be dangerous. If the British Empire were an honest unity, its dismemberment could not react favourably on world affairs. The pertinent charge, however, against the British politicians is not that they are grasping imperialists, but that they have no conception of imperialism at all. Certainly they judge with one quarter of the world's surface and one fifth of its population under the delusion that they are managing an empire. But in fact, thanks to their greed and their materialism, the British Empire of today is merely a geographical expression. The whole tragedy of the empire lies in a democratic preference for extensively and intensity. The great portion of the earth over which King George VI, Defender of the Faith, rules has not been economically developed to more than 10% of its available capacity for development. Yet there is starvation of the most abominable nature in India, there is unemployment in Britain, and 55% of the total population of the colonial empire is suffering from malnutrition. England had the opportunity of developing intensively the greatest estate that the world has ever seen. That opportunity was sacrificed to the interests of international finance. More and more territory was sought for the purpose of gratifying the Jewish merchants, but no thought was given to the full development of natural resources for the benefit of the inhabitants. For example, the Boer Wars were not fought in order that every inch of South African territory may be made to yield up its store of natural wealth. They were fought in order that the Jews of Joburg might gamble in gold and diamonds at the expense of the agricultural population. It may be taken as an absolute rule that throughout the vast extent of the empire for many years, international finance has skimmed the profitable surface and spurned the honest wealth below, which means hard work rather than quick profits. Truly, the city of London has created an empire of jewels in which men buy for lack of bread. And mark you, when the hungry complain, they are given, just like the hungry at home, not bread, but democratic principles. Just as liberal capitalism encouraged the ideology of democracy in England, so it has done so in the empire, with the result that many poor, simple peoples have been led to believe that if they only get parliaments as good as that of Westminster, their troubles will be over. Poor, innocent creatures. It is impossible to lay too much emphasis on the fact that most of the so-called democratic movements in the empire are welcomed by the international financiers, and for these reasons. 1. These financiers hate political coordination in reality. They prefer to weaken the bonds of authority, lest authority should demand justice. 2. They are interested not in political development, but in economic exploitation. 3. When nationalist movements resort to force, the excuse arises to use military measures for which there would be no pretext otherwise. These measures can generally achieve a certain economic object much more quickly than patient negotiation or good government. 4. If the nationalism of the imperial peoples can be safely diverted into the channel of democracy, it will be as harmless to international finance as every democratic system must necessarily be. In India, for example, the nationalist movements have received encouragement from many English politicians, and, in theory at any rate, many concessions have been made to the idea of democratic autonomy, but I do not know of one prominent English politician who has proclaimed the necessity for a financial revolution as a necessity preliminary to the solution of India's problems. So long as Indians are kept talking about representation, councils, responsibility, federation, democratic machinery and all the rest of the democratic mumbo-jumbo emancipating from Westminster, so long will all their agitation fail to bear on the real troubles of their land. The same is true in principle of Scottish nationalism. There are honourable exceptions, but most of the Scottish nationalists seem to think that their battle will be won when Scotland has a parliament of her own. They might have made more progress had they not laid emphasis on their desire to create at Edinburgh something as revolting to common sense as the assembly that sleeps at Westminster. When they talk quite worthily of the national aspirations of the Scots, they usually omit to say that they propose to do with the Royal Bank of Scotland, which has so many intimate associations with international finance. An interesting point there, Royal Bank of Scotland was one of the banks, I believe, involved in the crash that started in America and spread around the world. So they was, quote-unquote, bailed out. So you can see what Joyce is writing here in 1940 about the Royal Bank of Scotland becoming the same as the Royal Bank of England is basically what has happened. Continue. A healthy feeling of nationalism is both natural and desirable, but it is hard to resist the impression that the Jewish lords of finance are seeking to exploit this feeling in certain places in order to distract attention from the need for economic revolution. History has shown that, in certain circumstances, it is quite possible for different races to belong in concord to a common system and to accept discipline under it. Such a condition may, in time, develop into an integral unit and the world profit thereby. But this conception of empire demands both economic justice and economic progress. If neither exists, complaints are bound to arise, and, when they do arise, it is much easier for the architects of evil to talk about new experiments in government than to remedy the fundamental grievances by abandoning the system that causes them. International finance is, unhappily, the master of the British Empire, and has been for some years. The consequence is that whilst the financiers have reaped a rich harvest, the whole structure has been politically disintegrating for the last 20 years. As a general rule, conditions are worse in proportion to the power that Whitehall exercises in any particular part of the British Commonwealth of Nations. This fact is sad, but it must be faced. The appalling conditions, for example, in Newfoundland, are a most perfect argument for the concentration of Britain on her own affairs and for the abandonment of her pretense that she has a sacred mission to settle the affairs of Central Europe. One quarter of the population is starving, and tuberculosis stalks along with poverty as its faithful companion. whilst there can be little doubt that the greatest poverty in the empire is found in India, it is hard at present to obtain exact information as to its extent. With regard, however, to the so-called colonial empire, which is directly subordinate to the Whitehall, no such difficulty arises. The truth can be read in the first report of the Committee on Nutrition in the Colonial Empire, published in 1939 by His Majesty's Stationery Office. It consists of two volumes full of information, and merely to quote particular passages can give no adequate idea of the indictment against democratic imperialism which the whole embodies. Amongst the committee were Sir John Orr, Sir Edward Mellenby, Professor Carcade, Professor N.F. Hall, and other famous scientists. Although quotation is inadequate to convey the extent of the evil which exists, a few passages may be cited by way of example. The committee states, "The data available does not enable us to say with any accuracy, except where definite deficiency diseases are reported, that this or that deficiency exists this or that territory. But we believe that almost everywhere health is impaired to a greater or less degree by malnutrition. We would go so far as to say that for every recorded case of a specific deficiency disease, there are hundreds of cases of absence of full health, due in part at least to malnutrition." The first general conclusion of the investigators is this. To sum up, colonial diets are very often far below what is necessary for optimum nutrition. This must result not only in prevalence of specific deficiency diseases, but in a great deal of ill health, low resistance to other diseases, and in a general impairment of well-being and deficiency. There is in our minds no doubt whatever that these conclusions are correct. Then the committee deals with the causes of this scandal. The main causes of malnutrition in the colonial empire are, in our view, first, that the standards of living is often too low, and secondly, that there exists widespread ignorance. A low standard of living and ignorance react to some extent to one to another. If there were greater wealth in the colonial empire, governments could spend more money on removing the ignorance, and if there was less ignorance, the available resources would be used to greater advantage than they are at present. It is all very well to pitch a vicious cycle of poverty and ignorance, but the committee would have exceeded its terms of reference if it had dealt with the real problem, finance. The most pertinent observation which can be made upon the whole problem is that £600 million have been lost by Britain in the countries of South America. Of course, much of the investment in these countries has brought high dividends to the investors, but every single penny placed in the Crown colonies has been begrudged. We must repeat that the international financier would far sooner risk his money in the hope of high profits than invest it for a relatively low return in the development of lands where hard and patient work is needed before any considerable profit can be reaped. Of course, there is no difficulty in finding capital to finance the production of useless precious stones or an easily won commodity like sugar. There is always an abundance of the cheapest labour available. But the scientific and conscientious development of the agricultural resources of this vast empire would be deemed a bad business proposition by the Jewish imperialists of the city. They want the dream. The microbes can have the skim. The report provides some illuminating comments on colonial wages. One passage runs. It would probably be easy to compute that the wages paid by, say, 10 a month in East Africa, 15 a month in West Africa, or 1 to 1.3 per day in the West Indies, are not sufficient to provide a man and his family with the food that they ought to have. For instance, it has been calculated that the minimum sum required to obtain a reasonably good diet, not an optimum diet, in Freetown, Sierra Leone, is between 6 and 7d per head per day, or say 15 shillings per month. That is just about the average wage received by the urban labourer, so that according to this computation, if he is to feed himself decently, there is nothing left at all for the food of his wife and family, let alone for his housing, clothing, etc., unless he has some other source of income. Yet in the face of these figures, British politicians dare to talk about oppressed Czechs and Poles. They conveniently forget that in their colonial empire, the rate of infant mortality lies between 10% and 40% of all the children born. Even more presumptuous is the thesis advanced at Westminster that Germany is not qualified to possess or administrate colonies. Whatever her failings might conceivably be in this respect, Even if she deliberately tried to ruin her colonies, it is hard to see that she could do worse than successive British governments have managed to accomplish. In Cyprus, for example, a considerable number of the rural populations are, on account of poverty, definitely underfed and thus liable to tuberculosis, colds, infectious diseases and epidemic ophthalmia, the incidence of which is high, especially among the underfed. Since 1931, the Cypriots have been forced to accept British rule by military measures. Tens of thousands of peasants are homeless, and the taxation imposed upon the people has been intolerably oppressive. Yet if Germany had said, "We don't like the way you are handling weaker people of a different race," and declared war on Britain in the interest of small peoples who wanted to be free from her, the British politicians would be very surprised indeed, as would the whole British people. Yet she would have an incomparably better case than Mr. Chamberlain had on September 3rd, 1939. In this chapter, every effort is being made to avoid both recriminations and the tu quoque style of argument. But it is impossible to ignore facts. It is not necessary to recite a list of crimes committed by Britain to establish the fact that her empire depends on the use of principle of force. Every sensible human being knows that force may be either rightfully or wrongly applied, and there is no intention here of conducting a series of ethical inquiries. It is a fact that the South African Dutch would declare a republic tomorrow if the threat of British force did not prevent them from doing so. The same is true of ERA, that's Southern Ireland. The present century has seen the use of armed force against both the South African Dutch and the majority of the Irish people. Rhetorical embellishments are not needed to describe either case. If England claims that she had good reasons for acting as she did, Germany can claim to have had better reasons for moving to protect her own flesh and blood in Poland or other areas torn away from her by force. In both South Africa and Ireland, the history of England's failure has been tragic. In the former, the Jewish trader in gold and diamonds was granted a monopoly of the Union Jack, with the result that the Boer farmers felt themselves compelled to fight for their lives against an Oriental despotism. If 1/6 of money invested and lost outside the empire, in South America alone for example, had been given to Ireland, they might have continued that cooperation between her and England which provided British history with Burke, Goldsmith, Sherrington, Wellington, Boyle, Roberts, French, Beattie and Carson. As though, however, by an inevitable destiny, international finance wound its coils round the heart of England, and its venom was carried throughout the bloodstream to the whole of the colonial and imperial system. Today, India is in a ferment. Nowhere has it been more fashionable than in England to talk about the necessity of democratic self-government for India. Here I express a purely personal opinion, which is intended to commit nobody else. If democracy has proved such a curse to Europe, there can be no justification for inflicting it upon the unsuspected Indians. In fact, they have no political unity. The princes, the Muslims, and the Hindus of British India are not likely to agree. In my own opinion, autocracy in some form or other is the natural lot of the Indian peoples for generations to come, and it is a form of government which they understand and respect when honestly administered. India's most urgent troubles are economic. Her cotton mills have been used to grind out of her slave labour cheap goods which have destroyed Lancashire. Nowhere has any attempt been made by the government to bring about the financial revolution which is fundamental to Indian well-being. Until the people are freed from the grip of the bunya or moneylender, they will be miserable. Moreover, the soil could be made to yield up the needs of the people, but only by a dictatorship strong enough to override all private interests, strong enough to base the whole financial system on the realities of production and consumption. No doubt Indian readers will be disappointed if I write this strain, but in objective argument it is necessary to remember that British irrigation has saved the lives of millions and that in the old days at least, British administration won the respect which it deserved. With the onset, of course, of the Sassoons and their friends against the Indian urban population, the issue became confused. Moreover, Britain could have done infinitely more than she did, but credit must be given where credit is due. It was not the British administrators, but the financier behind British governments that brought about the present situation. The tariffs against British cotton goods and British steel were imposed by arrangement between the Shusters and their fellow Jews, not to protect the Indian worker from his bowl of rice, but to protect the vested interests of international Jewish finance at the expense of England herself. India was mapped out as a special field for Jewish exploitation, partly because of her natural wealth, and partly because of the disgraceful cheapness with which labour could be obtained. It was Montagu, a Jew, who began to stir the Indian peoples out of their pathetic contentment. In quotes, it was Rufus Isaacs or Lord Reading who pursued this policy. These gentlemen were afraid that the conscience even of a British Parliament might revolt against the labour condition which capitalists in India had brought into being. The solution was, then, some government less closely connected with Westminster for the Jews and have the supreme confidence that they could bribe any Indian government into amenability. Despite the reforms which have taken place, Indian finances are still controlled by the Shuster School, and whatever proposals were made by British Democrats for the granting of autonomy to India, it was always understood that the army should remain there to make sure the capitalist interests should be protected. Nobody acquainted with India supposes that the peace would last long if the army were withdrawn. Nevertheless, it would be wrong to suppose that if it is therefore the sole purpose of preventing the Indians from quarrelling among themselves. The Indian nationalist is apt to blame England for everything. If he would only look behind the facade which the world England represents, he would see that he and the English themselves are victims of the same evil forces. The British Empire today is merely a conventional phrase. It is Britain's politicians who are to blame, and the fault did not begin with this generation. No true imperialism is compatible with the principles of international finance. That is why the Jew Einstein agreed to become president of the League Against Imperialism. As the head of a society pledged to smash up the British Empire, he was naturally, when he visited England, accorded the honours due to royalty, and that libidinous little nincompoop, Oliver Locker Lampson, mounted guard over him with a shotgun, lest any wicked Nazi should attempt to injure him. Photographs were published in the press, showing an exponent of relativity and his bodyguard, yet nobody had paid any more lip service to the Empire than this Sancho Panza with his shotgun. This incident reveals very typically the antagonism between Jewry and real imperialism. Naturally, a real empire would aim at and probably achieve autocracy or self-sufficiency. At any rate, such an achievement will not have been beyond the British Empire had it possessed any real unity. It was largely because England refused to treat her dominions and colonies any better than foreign nations that she lost their confidence. Even as early as the 18th century, the attempt to treat colonies as a mere source of profit was in large measure responsible for the American Revolution. Until 1933, then, the Jews hated the idea of the British Empire. In practice, as distinct from theory, they tolerated and controlled it as a means of spreading the ramifications of their finance more widely. But any suggestion that the empire should acquire the psychological basis of unity, and any suggestion that the countries of the empire should form an economic unit, was regarded by international finance as a menace. To say that all Jews adopted this attitude would be an exaggeration. But as a body, they have never had more than two uses for the British Empire. The first, prior to 1933, was the use of political power on behalf of their own financial interests. The second, since 1933, has been the use of this loose but potentially wealthy conglomeration of states, half-states, principalities and whatnot against National Socialist Germany. In plain language, it was not the post-war intention of Jewish finance that the empire should exist in any but a financial sense. But on the day when Adolf Hitler became Reichschancellor of Germany, all these plans were reversed. Examine every weakening of imperial ties between 1919 and 1933. A Jew will be found lurking somewhere in the background, whether it be Otto Kahn, Rufus Isaacs, Montagu or Samuel, Schuster or Hamar Greenwood. Examine every exhibition of imperial flag waving since 1933, and a chorus of Jews will be observed dancing in the foreground. Thus, the whole idea of that beneficial political integration, so helpful to purpose, has been lost from the British Empire, and the currents of empire building turned away. Perhaps there is no more shameful example of Jewish influence on British politics than the policy which England has been pursuing in Palestine for the last 2 years. Both Arabs and Jews were promised Pyromancy in the same region during the war. The Arabs got the promise first, but Chaim Wiseman's power over Balfour was such that he was soon able to exact from the British government an undertaking diametrically opposed to the pledge that was given to the Arabs. Nobody was more disgusted with the treatment meted out to the latter than T.E. Lawrence, who was mainly responsible for their having supported Britain during the war. In fact, of the many great servants of Britain who have been disillusioned, none was ever more disgusted than he. He did not live to see the full consequences of the betrayal. During the last 2 years, the Arab majority in the country of Palestine has been taught the meaning of democracy by a campaign of murder, torture, and arson carried out, most unfortunately, by the armed forces of the British Crown, both Jewish and Aryan. Needless to say, the civilian Jews have lent a hand in the good work. I'm not judging by the reports either the German or the British press, still less by any partisan pamphlets which have been published, but, in the main, by the accounts which I have had from British officers who were present during the perpetration of these atrocities and powerless to avert them. Officers who showed signs of an impartial attitude were very speedily removed from their command. One officer who, in a notorious case of homicide, insisted that disciplinary action should be taken against the servants of the Crown who were guilty of it and should be guilty of it, was removed from his post and sent on long leave. He was given full pay, but kept away from Palestine. Further details of the case cannot be given here, lest his position should be further prejudiced. How far all this oppression fits into the scheme of democracy was delicately suggested by the late Anthony Crossley in the House of Commons on May 22, 1939. He said, "I do not believe that there has ever been a debate in this House when this House would have been more justified in calling to the bar an Arab speaker to explain the Arab point of view, viewpoints of his own countrymen and his own country. There are no Arab members of Parliament. There are no Arab constituents to bring influence to bear upon their members of Parliament. There is no Arab control of newspapers in this country. It is impossible almost to get a pro-Arab letter in the Times. There are in the city no Arab financial houses who control large amounts of finance. There is no Arab control of newspaper advertisements in this country. There are no Arab ex-colonial secretaries who one by one get up and they themselves have made in the past. Finally, and I want the colonial secretary to pay special attention to this point, tomorrow night there is to be a broadcast. There is to be himself giving the government point of view. There is to be the honourable member of the Don Valley to advance what is obviously the Zionist point of view. There is to be the honourable member for Carnarvon Boroughs supporting the Zionist point of view. There will not be a supporter of the Arabs who can advance their point of view." The above passage is worth reading again and again. Mr. Crossley did not observe that there was also no Arab Secretary of State for War to give instructions to the troops in Palestine, but he went as near as he dared to delineating the Jewish control of Britain. At any rate, his analysis is a striking commentary on the freedom of speech which democracy permits. Now let us see what the chosen people were saying. There was neither reserve nor delicacy in their remarks. The Daily Herald of July 17, 1939, contains this report. "An appeal to the British people over the heads of the government is to be made by Jews. This was decided at an emergency meeting of the Zionist Federation of Great Britain and Ireland. Several hundred delegates summoned by telegram from all parts of the country attended the meeting. The chairman, the Rev. M. Palswig, said the Jewish people were in conflict not with the British people, but with the British government. Professor Bodetsky, head of the political department of Zionist organisation, said the terrorised Jews of Europe had either to accept this decree of death or defy it and live. They would do everything in their power to make the government's policy impossible to carry out. The decree of death was the government's open proposal for compromise between Jews and Arabs. Some sort of gesture had to be made in a desperate attempt to save the face of democracy. But of course, the government could not be expected to stand up for the threats of Professor Brodetsky. Even every such speech as he made was to signal for a renewed outburst of violence against the Arabs in Palestine. And just to show that Jewry was in earnest, some of the confraternity in Palestine shot British soldiers and police, only, of course, those who were not hostile to the Arabs. It may be recollected with some humour that Mr. Malcolm MacDonald increased the proportion of Jews in Palestine police with a view to facilitating the restoration of order. Kame Wiseman was a little more polite than Brodetsky. He said, on May 18th at the Kingsway Hall, "Far be it from me to use language which suggests a threat, but it is my duty to utter a warning against the inevitable effects of this policy." The warning, of course, took effect, and the lot of the Arabs became harder than ever. The government, with Hor Balisha grinning all the time, had made that feeble little gesture of affected impartiality which the public school tradition demands. It had been misunderstood, and accordingly there was nothing for it but to defer to the wishes of Sir Manuel Hor's favourite people. Space does not permit us to give details here to the hard lot that the Arabs have had to endure, but nobody wants to know the truth. Well, at least take the trouble to consult some representative Arab from Palestine, as well as his Jewish opponent. Unless the reader is prepared to take this step, he should refrain from assuming that the Arabs have no cause for discontent. The killing and maiming of Palestine Arabs, the starvation in the colonial empire, the sweating of slave labour in India, the growing unrest in Ireland, the resolve of the South African Dutch to cut adrift from England may or may not form sufficient material on which to conduct a case against the British Empire as it is now being and has for some time been conducted. But these facts do undoubtedly stop the politicians of Britain from declaring with a single shred of conviction that Germany is not qualified to possess a colonial empire. The agents of the Third Reich would have to be much more depraved than they are pictured by the Left Book Club before they could rival some of the more recent performances of British agents in Palestine. The claim that native populations must not be transferred to Germany control overlooks the fact that they were torn away from Germany without any pretense at consultation. Germany has never asked for one quarter of the world. Britain apparently does not think this modest fraction enough. Germany has not asked for a tenth or for a twentieth of the earth, although her population is nearly twice that of Great Britain and likely to be more. Germany has asked only for that which was developed, formed, fashioned and made productive by the honest sweat of German workers and pioneers, who have no reason to regard Britain's empire builders as their superiors. Again, the Fuhrer declared most solemnly that such colonial differences as existed between Germany and Britain should never be regarded as forming a casus belli. What colonies Germany had before the last war were won peacefully by hard work. Germany is not seeking a vast expanse of territory over which international financiers can play their game of speculation with diamonds and gold, whilst real wealth lies untapped and scorned. She wants merely for which her sons and daughters have worked, in order that she may play her part in the age-long struggle of man to wrest his needs from nature. Every inch of ground that Germany has at home and abroad, each single inch is and will be consecrated to the purpose of enabling ordinary people to live a fuller, happier and more prosperous existence. If this aim is contrasted with the almost inscrutable stimuli which agitate the British Empire and keep it in sticky being, there can be no doubt as to the course which the dynamic development of history will take. So that's the end of chapter 7. The next chapter is British Foreign Policy and the Ultimate Causes of This War. Some interesting stuff there. A lot of names I didn't recognise when he's talking about sort of the main characters and sort of heroes in the British Empire. Some are more well known than others. But obviously the point Joyce is making was that Britain had no kind of authority in the moral sense to accuse Germany of being imperialist and wanting to take land. As Joyce pointed out, the British Empire had been basically ran by the Jews, more specifically the Rothschilds, for quite a while. And of course, he pointed out about the concentration camps in South Africa of the Boers, which is a very shameful episode of British history, where most of the 75% of the 28,000 people who died in the Boer concentration camps were women and children. That's a documented fact. But Joyce points out, of course, that it wasn't the British themselves who was doing this, and it wasn't the British themselves who was benefiting from the diamond mines and the gold mines. It was the to Jewish financiers who was making that profit at the expense of Boer, South African, Dutch women and children, many of whom died. So thanks for listening. Hopefully I'll be back next Sunday with the next chapter. Take care and goodbye.